KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Hire officers who are ethnically diverse and who understand the values of different cultures. The Justice Department determined that the Seattle Police Department needs to address concerns about bias and using excessive force. Firefighters battling wildfires in Washington are being assisted by shifting winds today. About 100 firefighters with helicopters are trying to control a fire that has burned about 100 acres near the eastern end of Rife Lake in Lewis County. It's burning debris in an area that was recently logged. Another fire has burned about 60 acres of logging debris in the Capitol Forest near Little Rock in Thurston County. Department of Natural Resources spokeswoman Karen Ripley says winds have shifted to an onshore flow, bringing cooler, more humid air. She also says that firefighters are mopping up smaller fires near Tenino and La Center. Two men apparently drowned in separate accidents yesterday on Washington waters, one in the Stillaguamish River, one in Spanaway Lake. The Snohomish County Sheriff's Office says a man died while rafting on the Stillaguamish River near Arlington. Crews are searching for the body of a man who fell from an inner tube on Spanaway Lake. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
71 degrees in Seattle under a blue sky with lots of sun. Forecast calls for sun all day with an afternoon high of 84. Tomorrow, some clouds in the morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 72. Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits stay connected to customers using email marketing. Learn more at constantcontact.com. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:06.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. By the way, in case you had not heard, Steve Scherer is on sabbatical for 5 months. I'll be in his chair. Coming up this hour, Nancy Pearl will join us to talk about the power and the flaw of the memoir. Meanwhile, state lawmakers adjourned the legislative session on April 28th without getting a lot of the regular business they had on the docket completed. So Governor Jay Inslee summoned lawmakers back into special session. It convenes on May 13th, but work in Olympia is already underway. And joining us is regular guest Jerry Kornfield, who covers state politics for the Everett Herald. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Well, I know that really officially people don't come back to Olympia till a week from today, but Governor Inslee is trying to sort of jumpstart things.
I think he's trying to jumpstart things, but he'd do much better if it was like snowing outside. Instead, it's about 80 degrees. So I have a feeling he's going to have to wait a day or two before people are really focused on getting back to it. But he has asked the legislative leaders from the all four caucuses, Democrat and Republican. He's trying to get their budget negotiators and the leaders to start talking to each other face-to-face starting tomorrow. And I think his idea is that over the next four or five days of the week leading up to the special session, they can make some headway, and that come Monday when the session begins, they can report back to their caucuses that they have made progress towards a deal on the budget, and give people confidence that maybe the special session won't last 30 days. Now, I think that's his view. I think most people think that the special session is going to run the entire 30 days because there's so much work that they've left for themselves to do.
They didn't get a lot of major work done during the regular session, did they?
Well, no, and statistically, it actually sent fewer bills to the governor than most years. I think there was a man in the Secretary of State's office who had compiled stats and said it was like the fewest number of bills sent to the governor in close to 20 years. Now, that's probably a factor of the fact that they had the Senate was run by Republicans and the House run by Democrats. Mm-hmm. So when you have that kind of divided government, fewer bills move towards the governor's desk. But the number is going to climb during special session. I mean, they didn't deal with some education reform that they wanted to work on. They have a crackdown on drunken drivers, the repeat offenders they want to get to, and they've got two budgets, a capital budget and the operating budget, and there's a ton of bills related to both of those they'll have to pass. So the number will climb over the next month or so.
What is absolutely required by law of lawmakers? Is it just passing a budget?
Right. July 1st marks the beginning of a two-year budget cycle for the state. We have a two-year budget. So by July 1st, theoretically, they need to have new budgets for construction, operating, and transportation. Now, you don't have to spend any more money. You just have to adopt a budget. So what they're really fighting over is there's money that's going to come into the state over the next 2 years and they're trying to figure out how to spend it. But at the bare minimum, they should have budgets on the books starting July 1, and everything else could wait until a future legislative session, theoretically.
I understand that both the House and the Senate have come up with their own budget versions, so I'm wondering how different they are.
Well, the governor described them as light years apart. Essentially, in dollars and cents, they're about $1 billion apart, maybe $1 to $1.2 billion. And that number represents what the Democrats in the House, they want to raise taxes, not general tax. It's not a sales tax increase, but they want to close some tax breaks, and that would generate some revenue. They want to continue some taxes. They said we're going to go away at the end of June. They want to keep them on the books permanently, and that's going to affect lawyers, accountants, real estate professionals. So they want to raise $1.2 billion that way. The Senate doesn't want to do that, so their budget spends $1.2 billion less.
That's a lot of money, a big difference. It's hard to imagine that they're going to be able to bridge that gap in the next 7 days.
No, I don't think they'll bridge the gap. I would hope, they would probably hope that the House would like to see the Senate agree to taking some of those tax breaks and closing them. And there's a couple of other measures in there. They're called reforming taxes to deal with some legal battles that are going on with the state. So I think the House Democrats would love to hear them say, yeah, we will agree with you on this one, and this one. And, you know, they could get $300 million or $400 million that way. That might be all it takes to get a deal.
Let's talk about education for a second, because that I know that the majority caucus, which is the handful of Democrats who are working with the Republicans in the Senate, said that education was really a priority for them. We haven't really seen much action. There's various bills that have been talked about. What do you expect might actually come out of this special session?
Well, I think when everything is done and put to bed and they've gone home for good and they've adjourned for the year, you're going to see first, there will be more dollars and cents put into K-12, which is a kindergarten to 12th grade, the basic education programs. So there will be more money, maybe as much as $1 billion more into public schools. That is something everybody has talked about doing. But I think you have to give the Republican-dominated Senate a credit for sticking to it and wanting to put that money in. Then on the policy matters, I think what you're going to end up with is a perspective of the legislature that the schools that aren't doing well, we need to step in as a state a little bit faster and help them do well. The students who aren't doing well reading in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, by third grade, we need to deploy more resources. And the teachers who are not doing really well, we need to get them out, or at least give principals the power to get them out of the classroom on their campus and send them to another school, kind of like a sports team. Maybe a new environment will do the teacher better. Those kinds of policies, when they introduced them, were very kind of draconian. They've been watered down. They've been debated. Some have been set aside for a while by the House Democrats. But in the end, I think you're going to see some headway on all of those fronts, and they'll be able to claim that they have made the reforms that go along with what they say is the revenue. So they will feel very good about themselves.
So that's K-12. As the mother of a child who's going to start college in the fall, I was interested to note that they don't even know what the tuition is going to be, at least at the University of Washington.
Yeah, there's a real problem there. The state was trying to allow the universities to set tuition, and then the courts and the attorney general kind of said, no, the initiative passed by voters last year, the latest version of an Iman initiative, put the tuition setting authority right back into the hands of the legislature. So that's part of why they don't know what's going to happen. The Democrats in the House are saying, you know, let's allow increases in tuition so they can keep generating some money. And the Senate Republicans want to cut tuition. And so that's why the schools just don't know which way to go. They don't have the power to do it themselves. And so they have to wait on the lawmakers.
We're talking with Jerry Cornfield. Just a last question, which it's interesting to note. It seems like we see special sessions now. They're not so special. They happen almost every year.
Yeah, it's getting people to feeling it. It's a regular session, and then you get one extra one just to get it right, I guess, or maybe two.
Well,
I came from California where they were lawmaking all year round. And you start to see these budgets, they get larger and larger and larger, and the issues get more and more complicated. And I think it's part of the problem. It's just not something you can come to work and 3 months later have dealt with major issues. The education of a million children, how do you do it right? That takes a little time.
Is there any talk about making the legislative sessions longer or perhaps full time?
No, no one would dare go down the path of full-time.
Maybe I should broach it now, Jerry.
No, there have been discussions about trying to move some of the key dates around. For example, they get a report on the budget, and they get a report on how much revenue they can expect in the next budget. They call it a revenue forecast. They get that in March. Some would like to get that in February because they use it to write their budgets. They think that would allow them more time to write and debate a budget. In the past, there have been offers of legislation to actually take a break, go about 60 days, take a break, and come back. The theory being in that break, everybody on their own can read the bills, negotiate, do some work, and then come back and spend a month and get it all done. Hmm. So you still have 105 days. You would just they would be spread out over a longer period of time. And so maybe something along that lines down the road.
Yeah, I can see a full-time legislature goes the way of income tax here in Washington State. Jerry, thanks for taking time to talk to me today.
Okay.
Jerry Cornfield covers Olympia and the Washington State Legislature for the Everett Herald, and you can hear him Mondays, usually, here on Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
KUOW 1017, librarian action figure Nancy Pearl joins us to talk about memoirs in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Graham and Dunn, a full-service law firm focused on helping Northwest businesses tackle challenges faced on the path to success. Online at grahamdunn.com, located on Pier 70. Business law from a different point of view.
Warm and sunny in Seattle, 73 degrees. It'll be even warmer and sunny this afternoon with a high of 84.
Join KUOW for the 2013 Seattle International Film Festival, May 16th through June 9th. Now in its 39th year, SIFF is the largest film festival in the United States, showcasing 447 films from 85 countries this year. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
1018. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A friend of the accused Boston Marathon bomber is due in court for a bail hearing on charges he lied to investigators. That's in the news at 11.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Also at KUOW.org, by the way. Last week, the annual Seattle Reads Project of the Seattle Public Library focused on Gregory Martin's rather unconventional memoir, Stories for Boys. It's a book about how Martin's father attempted suicide after his wife discovered his hidden homosexuality. You might have heard the interview that we did with Gregory Martin last week. Well, it's interesting because memoir is kind of a hot genre, and it seems like it has been so for quite a while. We have in the broadest strokes imaginable, painful memoirs about sexual abuse or incest. We have inspirational memoirs or partial stories like Cheryl Strayed's Wild, which is in itself wildly popular. There are what I call the cooking memoirs, which are, you know, how I found true love over food. And we also have memoirs by people who don't even seem like they're old enough to have written about their lives yet. We're joined by librarian Nancy Pearl. Bernard called you an action figure, but you are definitely a reader figure, and you have your literary pulse, your finger on the literary pulse of the Puget Sound, if not the nation. It's great to have you in again.
Thank you, Marcy.
We are, just so you all know, we're going to make a list of the books that Nancy talks about, and that book will be on the Facebook page weekday on KUOW and later on the KUOW.org page, just so you all know. My burning question about this, what is the difference between an autobiography and a memoir?
Well, I'm not sure there is really a difference. I think maybe we've come to understand autobiographies as looking back over a full life. So somebody who's who's written a book about their life at 30, that's not an autobiography. I would say, but that's a kind of maybe false distinction. And
well, so is a book like Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking a memoir?
I think that's a memoir of that year.
Okay, so a memoir can be of a slice in time.
I think that's one way of understanding the difference. I tend to use them in the two words interchangeably, but I think we're not thinking in terms of autobiographies anymore. That sounds so ponderous. It sounds like a tome.
Well, I have to say, I read it. I liked the autobiography section in my school library.
Yes.
When I was in elementary school. I used to find them fascinating. There are also biographies and autobiographies.
Right.
You're just telling me I'm dated.
Sad to say, I think that's true.
Okay, so we're talking about memoirs of all types, and we'd love your phone calls at 206-543-KUOW or 1-866-NPR-KUOW, or you can email us weekday at KUOW.org. Do you think, I mean, what was the defining moment that all of a sudden memoir became the rage? Is there some book that you can point to?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that I can point to some book. I think that when everybody started looking more inward than outward and being concerned about their own lives rather than other people's lives, sort of the rise of selfishness, you could even say, that propelled memoir writing. Now, what propelled memoir reading, I think, is that many people, and I include myself in this group, have an insatiable curiosity about other people's lives.
Well, you, I know, are a great armchair traveler. And so there are,
right.
It seems to me that some of those books, some of the best travel writers are memoirists.
Yes.
Because they're accounts of your personal journey.
Right.
On a physical journey.
Yes. And I think that's Paul Theroux, especially his, I would say, especially his early books, and maybe his not the brand new one, but the one just before that, I think were among his just really wonderful ones. Michael Musha did a terrific memoir of his time in North Africa, which is called Between Terror and Tourism.
So do you, I know that you have classified, you've written about travel, but do you put those, they're not really travelogues. Are they memoirs? Is that just a big umbrella for all kinds of books?
I think memoir is a big umbrella for all kinds of books.
Okay.
And I think that you could categorize memoirs in the same way that we categorize fiction. But I think, as I think it is with fiction, a mistake to categorize memoirs that way. Because I think that there's so many different kinds of memoirs. I always like to think, or I have this, sort of love-hate relationship with memoirs. I mean, I just can't stand self-indulgence. I think that it's, that's really high on my list of sins.
Yeah, but when you're writing a memoir, you're writing about yourself.
I know, because the first two letters of memoir are me.
Yeah.
So, you have to do that. But I think that you can stand back a little, I find that the memoirs that I most enjoy, I do enjoy the travel memoirs. Mm-hmm. But in those, it's because you're learning about another place or another people or they have that. For the personal memoirs, I want them to have some meaning or something to say other than, look how terrible my life is.
So off the top of your head, one that you'd point out.
Okay. So there's a brand new memoir out that, and people who hear the title are going to say, well, of course you like that book because it has the word librarian in the title. But that's not the case. It's called The World's Strongest Librarian by a guy named Josh. His last name is like Harnagrain or something. But he grew up in a Mormon family in Utah. He has Tourette's. Huh. And he became a librarian. He works at the Salt Lake City Public Library, a beautiful, beautiful.
Okay.
Their downtown library is gorgeous. And he, in an effort to control Tourette's, he took up weightlifting. And
wow.
And this is the story of, you know, it's not a look at my life, feel sorry for me. It's a book that you learn not only about the Mormon religion, because he grew up in a quite religious family, and actually did one of the missions, and then had a kind of crisis of conscience in his life, and just had to decide what he was going to do. But it's a book so you learn about that, but you learn about from the inside out what it's like to have Tourette's. And he didn't have the kind of Tourette's where you shout out profanity. His were physical, uncontrollable tics, where he would like not be able to control his right hand punching himself in the face.
Oh.
And to read about that from somebody who isn't feeling sorry for himself, but is trying to understand himself, I just want to say this, he had a very happy childhood and has still a great relationship with his family. And I think that it's such a relief to read those.
Nancy Pearl's with us, and we're talking about memoir this month. Our phone number, 206-543-5869. That's 543-KUOW. Or email us, weekday@kuow.org. Before I go to the phones, I just have to say one of the most interesting memoirs I read recently was a graphic memoir, Marbles by Ellen Forney, which is about being bipolar.
Yes. I think if we're talking about sort of new types of books on the horizon, this whole graphic memoirs began with Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the classic one many years ago. I think it's the 50th anniversary of
holy moly,
of Mouse.
Oh my.
But Ellen Forney's one, Fun Home by Alison Bechdel. There's a really wonderful one called You'll Never Know, which is part of a trilogy.
And the books that I'm blanking on the name of the writer, the two that she was an author that came to Seattle.
Persepolis.
Yes.
Yeah, Marjan Satrapi.
Right.
Yes.
Those are memoirs.
Those are totally memoirs.
But more than memoir, because...
Yes, they do exactly the kind of thing that I like, which is give you a context and a historical background. But you can find wonderful graphic memoirs. There's one whose name is escaping me right now, but it's about an artist who she and her mother escaped from Eastern Europe just before the Holocaust, ended up in New York. She's never been back to Germany. She's hated Germany all her life for what they did to the Jews. And now there's an exhibition of her paintings there,
huh.
And she has to decide whether to go there. And her son has married a German woman.
And this is the book.
This is the book.
If any of you remember this, send us the title. Pandora writes on our Facebook page, the memoir that stands out for her is Stop Time by Frank Conway.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness. Stop Time is just a classic memoir. It's one of those reading experiences that you just know is going to stay with you for a long, long, long time. It's a great memoir.
We're talking memoirs, and we have phones open at 206-543-KUOW. Eric in West Seattle, thanks for your patience. You're on the air.
Hey. So, by Andrew Garcia, Tough Trip Through Paradise. It's an awesome memoir.
And
it covers a one-year period of his life, about the 1860s in Bozeman, Montana.
Oh. So it's an old memoir.
Right, right. He kept meticulous records, and it brings to light many things, like how Shakespearean in its makeup the speech was of the Indians in the area. It also shows, it's just a fascinating life, this whole guy growing up.
Is it in print, this book, Eric?
Oh, most definitely.
Tough Trip Through Paradise.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Garcia.
I've not heard of it. And Nancy either, and she's rarely stumped.
But, Gregory Martin, before writing Stories for Boys, his first book, Mountain City, is just another fabulous memoir.
And that's about, I want to thank you, Eric, for bringing this book up. Mountain City is about his Basque relatives.
In Utah. Yes, sheep herders in Utah. Just wonderful. Another terrific memoir by a poet is Richard Shelton's Going Back to Bisbee, which is the only book. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, a big city. I love the Pacific Northwest. I'm not fond of heat. But reading Going Back to Bisbee made me think that I could be happy living in a desert community. He just makes it. He brings it to life. And I have always, Bisbee is roughly between Tucson and Phoenix, and I have always wanted to go to Bisbee because of that book.
If there's a writer from Bisbee, and I'll think of her name because I'm losing my mind. I just want to bring Brian and Sammamish into the conversation because you're going to clarify memoir and autobiography, the difference between them, right?
Yeah. I hate to disagree with someone of the stature of Nancy Pearl, but... for me, there's a very simple difference between an autobiography and a memoir, and that would be that a memoir is a snapshot of time, as we discussed, kind of earlier, but a memoir is so where the event is actually the main focal point. It's one's perspective of an event, i.e. my time as Secretary of State for these 5 years, or, my trip through the civil rights movement in the South, or something like that, where the backdrop is the subject matter is really the focus of the story. It's one person's perspective. An autobiography would be the story of one's life. I went to elementary school. I was born here. This is what shaped my view. In 1967, I moved here and started doing this. Where the focal point of the book is actually one's life, whereas a memoir, the focal point of the book is one's experience with an event with a specific time range.
Okay, Brian, thank you for that clarification. I guess, Nancy, what you were saying earlier is that the very best memoirs are those that do have some kind of backdrop to them, but they don't all have...
No, and what we're seeing is people at the age of 30 or 35 writing memoirs about their lives. About a particular event.
Isn't that the influence of things like social media, Twitter?
Most definitely.
Have you seen any Twitter memoirs yet? Tweetoirs.
Would that be what they're called?
Good.
Right.
Hans emails, I love the genre of memoir. There are too many to list. Here are three favorite Western memoirs, all dealing with growing up in a changing West. William Kittredge's Owning It All, Mark Sprague, Where Rivers Change Direction, and Laura Bell's Claiming Ground.
Oh, I would agree, all of those. The William Kittredge, the one that I liked better than Owning It All, I think he did one called A Hole in the Sky, which I thought was just superb.
And so are they about the modern West, or
they're about the transition, I would say, from an older West to the modern West.
Nancy Pearl with us talking about the memoir in all its manifestations. And Bill on Queen Anne, if I'm looking at this correctly, you're about to name one of my favorite books, not just memoirs, This Boy's Life?
Yes. Actually, it's a part of a pair. This Boy's Life is a wonderful book and very popular. But... Tobias Wolff's brother, older brother Jeffrey Wolff, earlier wrote a book about his life with his father, the Duke of Deception.
Hmm. What makes these stand out for you?
First of all, the local connection that Tobias grew up in Concrete and writes about the Skagit Valley. But the two are a wonderful looks from different perspectives into a family that was very difficult for each of the two children, and yet both of them survived. Tobias more successfully than Jeffrey, but they're a wonderful two different perspectives into a difficult family.
Well, Bill, thanks for bringing those up. This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff and The Duke of Deception by Jeffrey Wolff. Have you read them both?
I have, and I think that Bill described them just absolutely accurately. They give you a picture of this family that was that fell apart and how the two sons reacted to it. I guess I would just say I'm not sure that Tobias. I think Jeffrey has had a very successful life as a novelist, and in addition to writing memoirs, as has Tobias Wolff. So I think both boys grew into men and came through that remarkably well.
Maybe Bill was thinking Tobias became more famous.
Yes, we and perhaps that book, This Boy's Life, was made into a movie, of course, and was so well known. But The Duke of Deception is a great book.
Okay. Thomas writes about, I've just lost it, Karl Ove Knausgård's My Struggle, a six-part Norwegian memoir. Have you heard of it?
I have heard about it, and actually it's being reprinted in English, or printed in English. I don't know if it was ever available before in English. Just now it's just starting to come out.
Is that because of the success of all those Scandinavian books?
It could be, yeah. We're certainly seeing a lot of those. But I have not read it, so I would be interested in hearing.
Okay. Well, Thomas, you can write a review for us. And I'm hoping I pronounced the name of that author correctly.
So hard to know.
I'm not an expert in Norwegian. Megan on Facebook suggests Sonja Livingston's Ghost Bread.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that.
Read that one.
No.
Okay.
I wish we had a little blurb about it.
Okay. Write more, Megan. 206-543-KUOW is our phone number if you'd like to talk about memoir with Nancy Pearl. Hi, Carol in Seattle. You're on the air.
Hi. The book I read recently, it's called In the Sanctuary of Outcasts. It's probably 15 years old, and it's the story of a fellow, a white-collar criminal in the southern United States, who went to jail for, I don't know, fraud. And the prison where he was sent to was essentially the National Leprosarium at Carville, Louisiana. And things have since changed, but basically at the time, this was a low-security prison that was held in the same facility where a bunch of elderly leprosy patients were living out their last days.
Wow.
And how much he learned from them as he kind of made his way through his atonement. It was a little whiny at times, but mostly it was a really fascinating view of these leprosy patients and a rather interesting experiment in criminal justice.
Wow. Well, Carol, In the Sanctuary of Outcasts, it's called.
Yes, and I'm sorry, I do not recall the author's name.
Okay.
But it's pretty easily found, and I do recommend it.
Okay, thanks. Neil White is the name of the author, says Katie Sewell, producer extraordinaire. Thank you for suggesting that.
There was an older title called Miracle at Carville about a young girl who was diagnosed with leprosy and sent there in the first half of the 20th century, and what it was like to have leprosy at that time. And somehow Carville, that whole period, has maybe slipped out of public discourse or knowledge.
Well, this sounds incredibly fascinating. We're going to continue our conversation about the memoir and take your calls and suggestions here on Weekday on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral programs in six different colleges. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
Well, it's going to be a warm, sunny day in Seattle. Some might even say hot. Forecast says we're going to reach 84 this afternoon, currently at 73 degrees. Overnight, a few clouds, a low of 53. Tomorrow, Tuesday, clouds in the morning, partly sunny in the afternoon, with a high of just 72.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
1040. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Open enrollment for health care under the Affordable Care Act starts in less than 6 months. What do we know and what don't we know about health care reform, and how long are these uncertainties going to last? We're going to get into all that in 30 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, and we're talking, as we do once a month, with librarian Nancy Pearl. She's actually more than a librarian. You were once a librarian. Is it like once a librarian?
Once, always a librarian.
Author, book lust, more book lust, book crush, book lust to go, and something just happened to my headphone here. I'm not sure if it's the mic or the headphone, but there we go. Just died. But now it's fine. You brought in a couple of memoirs, which is what we're talking about this hour.
I did. These are two, one maybe 8 years older than now in the past, but it's one of my favorite memoirs. And if people haven't read it, I just would highly recommend both. But the first is called A Girl Named Zippy.
And you have recommended that with me sitting
yes.
in this seat.
Yes.
So it is
many
a while.
Years ago.
Yeah.
Growing Up Small in Moreland, Indiana by Haven Kimmel. And it's funny. It's about a quirky family. And it's one of those books that I just like hug.
She's hugging it right now
because I just love it.
A girl named
Zippy. Zippy.
And you have another one. That's a smaller book. Now you are going to.
So wait. So here's how Haven Kimmel. I actually have a piece of paper in here that noting some of my favorite parts of this.
Because you love it so much.
Because I loved it so much. She's describing a family, and she's saying their life in Moreland had all the marks of a second chance gone ugly. And then she's talking about her next door neighbors, the Newmans. She loves to go over there, and she says dinner at the Newmans always involved the fry daddy. I don't think they actually ever turned it off. The food groups, as represented by Debbie Newman, were fried meat, bread, Coke, ice cream. And then Zippy says, she was an excellent cook.
Well, I think the fried genre is right up a 10-year-old's alley.
Right.
The other book is culinary.
It is.
More culinary.
Yes, it's one of those.
Memoir.
One of those food memoirs, but it's somebody who's not in the food industry. Writing about it, and it's called Cakewalk by Kate Moses. And Kate Moses's first book was a novel about Sylvia Plath called Wintering. But the thing that I loved about this book, again, it's a happy family, so there's not a lot of angst, and I like that. And second of all, there are recipes in this book, and the brownie recipes on page 108 and 109, the chewy version or the creamy version, are worth the $26 price of the hardback book, believe me.
Cakewalk, especially if you like brownies. I have to just digress a second and ask why we're seeing all these food industry folk memoirs all of a sudden.
And don't you think that that's just a symbol of where our concentration as a society is now, which is in
eating,
in food, and Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman and all the people talking about the slow food movement, Alice Waters, all of that.
Well, but the slow food movement is interesting. These books, this is almost. There's a spate of them, and they're all about how I found love through X. I mean, they're love stories. Essentially, they're romance novels, romance memoirs.
Oh, really? Because I'm thinking of like the woman who owns the restaurant, started the restaurant Prune.
Oh, that's a very good book.
Yeah, Blood, Bones, and Butter.
Yeah, that was a good book.
That had some kind of odd parts that you sort of wondered what she was leaving out. But
she is writing a new book, by the way, because she's traveling through the South eating in people's kitchens. I like food. So I read those books.
Yes.
I've read them all.
Yes.
And then I think, why did I read this?
Yeah.
Peg wants to know, what would you call A River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean? Is that a memoir?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, what I would do, the first thing I would do is look it up in a library catalog and see where they've placed it.
Okay.
I think it's tangentially a memoir, and I think if you're reading about, if you're interested in place, like the Mark Sprague book or the Kittredge books that we talked about earlier, that's where that book would fit. Well, so where would she put it?
I don't know. Peg, where would you put it? She wanted to know. It was a question. We're talking about memoirs. Julie writes on Facebook, I just read Townie by Andre Dubus III, and I really enjoyed it. The best memoir in a long time.
He's a great writer, and it's hard to imagine. You know, when you have a great writer, then you're going to end up with a pretty good memoir at the very least.
And at least it's good to read if they're good writers,
exactly.
So you don't feel like you've wasted your time. Hi, Joe in Tacoma. You have a memoir you want to recommend?
Hello?
Hi, Joe.
Hi. Actually, Olympia. But yes, kind of an interesting book I read for a book club a number of years ago. It's called Crashing Through by Robert Kersen. Probably a little bit more on the sciencey, geeky side of things for people who like Oliver Sacks. Those kind of reads. But it's about a man who was blinded when he was 3 years old and what happens. And just the other, without spilling the story at all, what happens after he regains his sight as an adult. And it's just fascinating. It's kind of, it's a little scientific techie for those people who are interested in neurology. But it's also a bit philosophical, which I found interesting and appealing.
The book is called Crashing Through. Who is the author again, Joe?
Robert Kersen. And I don't remember the spelling of his last name, whether it's with a C or a K.
Okay. Thanks for that recommendation. Maybe that'll be the next thing. We've had the cooking memoir. We're going to have science memoir.
Well, there are some great already science memoirs. There's a wonderful memoir called A Primate's Memoir by Robert Sapolsky, S-A-P-O-L-S-K-Y, which is about his life with... I always thought I'd be a lowland gorilla. I never thought I would be... the first line is just wonderful, where he talks about... You know, how he's not sure how he ended up with the primates in Africa, but somehow did. And it's humane and it's funny and it gives you a good picture of not only what a scientist's life is like, but also of that particular environment.
The crashing through, the spelling of that author's last name is Kurson. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in reading that, Bruce on Seattle's Queen Anne. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hey, fascinating conversation. I had a question, but I did have a memoir that I thoroughly enjoyed, and that was A Long Row of Candles by Cyrus L. Sulzberger of the New York Times. And in part, that leads to my question. I'm really interested in determining the quality or importance of a memoir. How do you balance between the excellence of the writing versus the historical uniqueness of the perspective that we're gaining, you know, from the writer's perspective?
Huh. That is a very interesting question,
Bruce. Interesting
Bruce.
Question. I guess the balance would be different for every reader, depending on what's more important to them. If what's most important to you is reading about the period and you don't necessarily care about particularly graceful writing or, you know, wonderful use of metaphor or whatever, then it's going to be that kind of book that you're going to be most happy with. If it's the writing that you're really interested in or that you care most about, then I think it's going to be... It's not going to matter so much where the book is set or what the book is about. It's just that you're going to appreciate the literariness of it.
Thanks for that question. Yeah. Our phone number, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Alexandra Fuller wrote a couple of books about her time in Africa. And the first one is the only one I read. But the reason I loved it so much was that she evoked the place so sensually, I guess right. That's the right word for it. I could, you know, she talked about the smell and the feel. And,
right.
I don't remember the book. I just remember Africa.
Yes. And Let's Not Go to the Dogs Tonight.
Yes.
Is Alexander Fuller's book. And I think that's what the best writers can do. I think in many ways, you know, I started with Paul Theroux, might as well, you know, bring up his name again. I think that's what Paul Theroux did so well before he started being so disdainful of the people that he met in all of his middle books. But his early book and his, oh, I wish I could remember what his second to the last book was, because it was really wonderful.
So we were talking about A River Runs Through It,
yes.
And Peggy mailed back. She thinks she would classify that book in memoir, but you're right. I'm with the guy who distinguished between memoir and autobiography. MacLean wrote about a time in his life, but not his whole life. And then she says, thanks. She's enjoying listening this morning.
Good.
Robert, we're back on the food memoir genre. Food plus restaurants plus bad boy irreverence equals kitchen.
Yeah, Anthony Bourdain.
Kitchen Confidential.
Right.
It wasn't entertaining, and then it went downhill for Anthony Bourdain. I mean, that was like this great revelation of a book.
Yes, and I think that was one of the first...
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ruth Reichel's somewhat memoirs, somewhat, I don't know,
they are memoirs.
Kind of a hybrid. They are memoirs. You know, that was some of the earlier ones. But Anthony Bourdain, I think, really in some ways took that food memoir in a different direction with Kitchen Confidential.
It was a very fun read.
Yeah.
Katie says, Paul Theroux's The Tao of Travel, Enlightenments
no,
from... That's not it. Okay,
that's
Katie,
not it.
Keep on
it's
searching.
About, it's about Africa.
Well, Africa. Maybe it's just we'd like to read about Africa because so few of us get to go there.
Yeah.
Hi, Sarah on Capitol Hill. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi. My memoir that I loved, I read it probably 30 years ago, if not more, but it's West with the Night by Beryl Markham.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Amazing
yes.
stories, but also the way she wrote it, it still sticks with me. It's gorgeous.
What did you like besides the amazing memories? Was it the quality of the writing, the evocation?
The quality of the writing, definitely. I mean, the stories were amazing, and she was an amazing woman. You know, she sort of was held up as an example of this is such a cool way to be a person. But the writing, I remember the writing, just gorgeous passages, and of course don't have any marked in my book the way some people do. But it's just brilliant, and I haven't seen it in forever, and I would highly recommend it.
Is it still in print?
I'm sure it's still. I would be surprised if it weren't in print. Another wonderful memoir by a novelist, where the main event of his life was World War II, being a pilot in World War II, is James Salter's Burning the Days. Now, that's a memoir that you read not only for the story of his life, but the way he tells it.
Well, thanks for that call, Sarah, because
yeah,
I've forgotten
that. Yeah, that's reminded me of that.
Yeah, West with the Night. Sonia emails in with a book that I have read, which I guess was a memoir, The Curve of Time by Wiley Blanchett, which is a story about a woman and her five kids, and they... she was a journalist, and her husband had died, and they were all in this little boat, and they're traveling through the Gulf Islands, essentially,
yes.
But in the 20s, if I'm not mistaken.
In the 20s or 30s, not sure.
And it was, I mean, it wasn't anything like it is now, and they encountered tribal... it's a lovely book.
It is. All of those kind of early Pacific Northwest books, Living High is another one. There's one by Constance Hendricks called Down the River Wild, where this woman takes her, this woman and her two daughters canoe, I'm not sure, because I can't remember, through Alaskan and Northern Canada waters. Oh, it's such a good book.
Wow. Okay. That's not. This we're back in the sort of travelogue-ish memoir. So it's these are good because we're going to bring Nancy in here for sort of shorter segments for summer reads. But I'm putting some of these books up on the summer read.
Yeah.
And actually, Curve of Time is a summer book because this is what she did in the summer with her kids. I think she lived in Toronto or Vancouver the rest of the time, and she wrote for news publications.
So then we have to put the Down the River Wild, the Constance Helmerich book. I'll let you know what the whole thing about it. But it was very good.
So Katie Sewell says the last train to Zona Verde, my ultimate.
No, the one just before that.
The
Katie.
One before that, Katie. There's a lot of books that Paul Theroux has written. Hi, Judith on Capitol Hill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to recommend Speak Memory by Vladimir Nabokov. It's a beautiful. Beautiful memoir, beautifully written, and in addition, it adds so much depth to what Russia and the early part of his childhood looked like at that time. That historically, it's actually a really wonderful memoir. Also,
I love the name of it, Speak Memory.
Yeah,
and of course, he was a good writer.
Yeah, right. I would agree. It's a wonderful. It's just a terrific memoir.
Thank you so much for that one. We're talking with Nancy Pearl this hour on Weekday, and I had no idea Paul Theroux had written this many books. Hans emails, I think you're seeking Dark Star Safari.
Oh, thank you, Hans. Dark Star Safari.
Okay.
Overland from something to something.
All I've is an iPhone. So.
Okay. All right.
All right. Dark Star Safari. If you think this one's good. Whoa, I just threw my pen at you. I didn't mean to.
That's fine.
But you caught it for me.
I caught it.
I was so excited about it.
Dark Star Safari is one of the best of my favorite is The Great Railway Bazaar, which I think is many people's favorite. My second favorite is Dark Star Safari.
Okay. Everybody write that down.
Yes.
We go to Vashon Island. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I haven't read these books in years, and I'm having a real hard time remembering the first one I read, but the woman's name was Dervla Murphy.
Oh, yes, Dervla Murphy.
And she wrote Freeling Wheeling Through Madagascar, which was a trip she took when she was 50, I think, with her daughter. But the first book about she must have been in her 20s, and she went overland to Nepal to take care of Tibetan refugees. And this was back in the 50s. It's a fabulous book.
Yes. I include many Dervla Murphy books in Booklust to Go because I'm a huge fan of her book. She was this intrepid woman and just set off on her bicycle.
Wow. Well, just like Willie Weir, who's
yes.
an intrepid cyclist
yes.
and writes about it.
He does.
Well, so this is it. Maybe this is the theme of the summer, going somewhere.
Going somewhere.
Especially for me, I'm not going anywhere. Thank you for that, by the way, Mary. And just in the last bit of time, Gerald says, is it memoir?
You know, I'm just an old Detroit girl.
All right, we're going to say memoir.
Memoir.
What do you think of Richard Ford's memoirs? He wants to know.
Richard Ford's memoirs?
That's what he says. I haven't read any. Okay.
I know Richard Ford's, like, the sports writer in Canada is a wonderful novel.
It is a great novel. And then last question in the brief bit of time, some memoirs are challenged by people as being inaccurate.
Oh, I think all memoirs are inaccurate. And I would make an argument that all memoirs should be in the fiction section. There is no such thing as absolute truth, and you remember things differently moment by moment and day by day and mood by mood. And so I think that's what you take going. That's the knowledge you take going into the memoir.
Nancy Pearl is the author of Booklust, More Booklust, Booklust to Go, Book Crush. She's here every month, and we're going to bring her in a little more often over the summer to give you, sort of a few titles to get you through your summer if you're just lazing about in a hammock somewhere. Lucky you, and you'll want to read. We're going to have these titles later today at KUOW.org and at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Nancy, it's always great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Marcy.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette's the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. I'll be back tomorrow in this chair.
10:59. A King County death penalty case is heading to the Washington State Supreme Court. Our full report on that is in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. The campaign for Seattle mayor is underway. Incumbent Mike McGinn is facing seven challengers. We want to know, what are the key issues that you'd like to see addressed by Seattle's next mayor? Call our feedback line right now and leave us a message, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. What are the key issues you want Seattle's next mayor to tackle? That's this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the EnviroStars Business Certification Program, recognizing EnviroStars Fiddler on the Tooth in Seattle for its commitment to environmentally sustainable business practices. A directory of businesses meeting certification standards is available at EnviroStars.org.
Battle stories from the corporate race to the top.
When my son was a newborn, I tried to do everything all at once. I had a treadmill in my son's room, and I would be on the treadmill working out and trying to do email. I think I quickly realized that was ridiculous.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.